coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Our Races to Watch series ahead of November's general election continues with a look at the races in House Districts 34 and 36, two races that could help give Democrats a House supermajority. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a peer mentorship program that helps those facing a breast cancer diagnosis.
Our whole purpose is to try to calm someone down. You heal better if you are not stressed.
And as Halloween approaches, History Matters dives into Delaware's haunted history with a local author. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is highlighting a series of races to watch. And the next general election showdown we are examining is in Kent County. The race for Delaware's 34th House District seat is another where an incumbent Republican is trying to maintain their hold on a seat in a district where registration numbers increasingly give Democrats an edge. This week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee takes a look at this race and whether this seat could flip from red to blue as Democrats pursue a House supermajority.
The 34th House District has had the same Republican representative for a decade.
My name is Lyndon Yerrick. I am the current state representative in the 34th District.
This November, the House Minority Whip faces a new Democratic challenger in the general election.
Hi, my name is Tracy Miller. I am the Democratic candidate running for state representative in the 34th Representative District.
Yerrick is the latest in a long line of Republicans to hold this seat, dating back over 30 years. At the same time, the district is increasingly taking on a Democratic flavor. When Yerrick was first elected in 2014, Democrats held a 900-voter registration edge. That's grown to nearly 2,100, with independents now outpacing Republicans in the district. And since Yerrick entered office, Kent County has gone for the Democratic nominee for president in each election except 2016. Overcoming that Democratic edge is part of Yerrick's argument for returning to Legislative Hall, selling himself as a buffer against a, quote, one-party rule in the state.
Most governments are going to give and take a little bit better when there's some sort of balance. We can look at a variety of benchmarks and see how one-party rule has worked within this state. And for anybody who wants to double down and say we need to do more of what we've been doing, inspecting any improvements, I don't think that's going to happen.
But Miller says if Delawareans want more Democrats, she's running to give residents in the 34th House District the opportunity to flip this seat.
There's a whole bunch of folks in the 34th that don't feel like they've ever been heard. And I hope that I can be that person that represents everyone and not just the few. And that includes small businesses.
Miller currently works for Forward Journey, a nonprofit day program for adults who are disabled. She's the director of development and finds funding for the organization's programming. Yerrick works as a regional consultant for JLK Political Strategies. Both candidates have plenty to say about education. Yerrick is calling for an overhaul of some current practices along with some simpler reforms.
We need to revamp our standardized testing. We need to provide more spending flexibility back to the districts. We need to get rid of the unit count system. One of five or six states that still fund public education that way. It's ridiculous.
Miller agrees it's time to move on from the unit-based system.
I think it's just standard knowledge of what's happening in our school systems. It's not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. It's a state issue. So I'm glad to hear that he is talking about the unit-based system too.
And Miller says that change to the funding system needs to be made with equity in mind.
When we talk about education, folks like to talk about everything being equal. Well, with education, it can't be equal because when you give equal amounts of money to each school district, that actually puts more money into the affluent school district pocket and less money into the school districts who are struggling.
Miller and Urich also discuss the workforce and economy in their platforms, but they tackle the issues from different angles. Urich focuses on job creation, hoping to streamline things like permitting and approval processes, which he says hold up small businesses and drive up costs. Urich believes in giving individuals and entities more flexibility and fewer regulatory restrictions to promote private sector growth.
But job creation is about the wealth that can be created for that small business where still two-thirds of all the jobs here in the state are of employers 10 people or less. So that is my focus, job creation versus just saying economic development.
Miller lists affordable workforce housing as a key issue that greatly affects Kent County. She references State Senator Russ Huxtable's work on the issue, which included a seven-bill legislative package introduced in March as a step in the right direction. Six of Huxtable's bills were signed into law, and Urich voted for all of them. Miller and Urich acknowledge healthcare and accessibility to healthcare as major issues for Delawareans. Urich supported legislation that offered loan forgiveness to primary care providers in Delaware-based residency programs.
It's quite disappointing that almost a third of all Delawareans are on Medicaid. That has not moved the mark in years. So what can we do differently? We need to look at non-state entities that participate with our health insurance plan to get a fantastic opportunity.
This year, Delaware lawmakers passed a bill requiring health insurance providers to cover abortions, barring religious entities that may be excluded. Urich voted against the bill, which was signed into law by the governor in September. Miller agrees there's a problem with accessibility in the state and suggests public and private partnerships. She says, like Urich, that there aren't enough providers in Kent County.
Folks, especially folks in state government and local government, don't want to use the word crisis because it scares people. And that's, I understand that. But what we have is, it's kind of a tiered problem. You cannot get people to work here if you're not willing to pay them.
Both candidates are running on public safety as well.
So whether it be with the fire departments, volunteer fire departments, or our law enforcement presence, public safety is the highest priority that any government should take.
On his campaign's website, Urich ties supporting the Second Amendment to public safety. He says he introduced legislation a few years ago that would increase penalties for committing a violent crime using a firearm. Had it passed, first-time offense penalties would have gone from 3 to 5 years, and second-time offenses would have gone from 5 to 10 years.
We need to hold them accountable and leave the majority of individuals who exercise their right with every legal capacity to do so, to have them to be able to protect their family, like go hunting, shooting, or collecting. That's their right, and they deserve to have that right.
Miller says she has a personal tie to public safety.
I am the daughter of a police officer, so public safety is super important to me. And I hear it when I knock doors.
She says she wants to help put more money toward community resource officers to further engage with people and see what the community wants out of their public servants. Miller also connects public safety to the environment. She says the effects of climate change are here, and they call for responses like raising the roads in eastern Kent County to respond to flooding in the area. Miller also stresses inclusion and diversity. She says the state has to do better.
We have to be better when it comes to students. We have to be better when it comes to women. We have to be better when it comes to Black and brown folks. It's not a static thing. It moves. It flows, and we have to be in that discussion at all times.
In the campaign's final push, Urich is asking for another chance to work for the 34th District.
It's been a privilege over these last 10 years to serve and represent the individuals in the 34th District here in Central Kent County. So I think I serve the individuals inside Legislative Hall and outside of Legislative Hall, and that shows every 2 years with their commitment and their belief in me and their support on election day.
Miller, who is endorsed by the Delaware State Education Association, Planned Parenthood, several unions, and the Delaware Democratic Party, says she's trying to get people to know who she is and what she stands for to unseat a longtime incumbent who has never received less than 57% of the vote in any race.
He's an entrenched Republican that's been at the helm of this district for over 10 years. And this district has been in Republican hands for well over 20 years. So it's a heavy lift for me, and I respect that. So I knew I had a lot of work to do to make sure that happened. So I've worked really hard.
It's now up to voters to decide if the 34th House District remains a GOP stronghold, or the latest to flip blue in the General Assembly. Abigail Lee, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Abigail. And a reminder, Delaware Public Media's election coverage is supported by a grant from Delaware Humanities, a state program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Up next, we head to Sussex County to continue our Races to Watch series with a look at House District 36 in Sussex County, where another incumbent Republican hopes to fend off a Democratic challenger. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our Races to Watch series with another campaign in Sussex County, where Republican incumbent Brian Shoup faces Democratic challenger Ronnie Baltazar Lopez for Delaware's 36th House District seat. Shoup has held the seat since 2018, but won this year's GOP primary election by just 12 votes, leaving Baltazar Lopez wondering if there's enough discontent to flip the Milford area seat blue. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich has more on the candidates in this race and where they stand.
The 36th District House seat hasn't been held by a Democrat since 1984, when Republican challenger V. George Carey flipped the seat by just 230 votes and held it until his retirement in 2010. Brian Shoup kept the seat in Republican hands in 2018 after serving as mayor of Milford for 4 years and on Milford City Council prior to that. Shoup owns and operates a few small businesses as well, including three locations of a full-service pet resort, Delaware Live News, and a local food market in Milford.
I think at heart, I'm an innovator. I'm an entrepreneur. I love to start businesses. I love to work with people. Between all of our businesses, we have over 40 employees that work alongside us every day. So I love mentoring and helping people get to where their next level is.
Shoup won his first two general elections handily over his Democratic opponents. In 2020, he faced his first Republican primary opponent, Patrick Smith, but prevailed easily with almost 70% of the vote and went on to win in the general election unopposed. But Smith challenged Shoup to a rematch this year, taking to social media to argue Shoup, quote, votes like a Democrat and does not uphold conservative values, particularly when it comes to Second Amendment rights. Shoup ended up beating out Smith by only 12 votes, and while both candidates support a recount, the Department of Elections said the margin was not slim enough to trigger one. As a sitting legislator, Shoup requested an audit of the votes, which ultimately confirmed his victory, and pledged to introduce legislation next year to raise the automatic recount threshold.
You know, this has kind of been, I feel like my legacy so far has been transparency in government, and I want to continue that even when it involves me as well.
But Shoup isn't in the clear yet. He now faces Democratic challenger Ronnie Baltazar Lopez. Baltazar Lopez currently works as the Director of Legislative Affairs and Communications for the Delaware Department of State. After a stint as one of Senator Tom Carper's staff assistants, he served on the Milford School District Board of Education for 3 years starting in 2019, while he simultaneously worked on the Attorney General's communications team. Baltazar Lopez says he decided to run because he believes the district needs a representative who can represent all of its residents, not just certain interests or populations, and wants to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to succeed.
I was born and raised here in Milford. I grew up in the public school systems, and I am a son of immigrants. So throughout my life, I've overcome challenges. I've had to address those challenges as I've grown up. And so taking those experiences as a son of immigrants has really translated into my professional career and in the public service.
Baltazar Lopez says the affordable housing crisis is something he is affected by personally, noting he cannot afford a home in Sussex County. The median home price is between $340,000 and $400,000 in Milford, yet the median household income is around $55,000. While affordable housing is an issue across the state, Milford is uniquely positioned in two different counties with the population on the rise, giving it some distinctive challenges. Among planning issues and development regulations, Baltazar Lopez wants to focus on support for first-time homebuyers.
I think at the state level, we can expand on either tax credits or low-interest loans And even continuing the down payment assistance from the Delaware State Housing Authority, as the some of those funds will be running out. And so making sure that we continue those investments in the next administration and the next General Assembly too.
Shoup, on the other hand, says that more government intervention is not necessarily the solution to this problem, arguing that adding more regulations and spending more state money over time has led to the exacerbation of the affordable housing crisis. He says in the short term, he would like to see codes written that enable more accessory dwelling units or secondary living spaces, as well as more mixed-use developments.
There also is long-term. We need to be able to look at strengthening our workforce development and making sure that we give people the tools they need in order to succeed either in the jobs that they are or to go out into the market and be able to be prepared to get a better job than they have now.
Perhaps one of the most important questions of this election cycle is how state leaders plan to tackle Delaware's outdated education funding formula and stagnant student outcomes. The 2024 statewide student assessment revealed only 40% of Delaware students are reading and writing at or above grade level, while only 33% are proficient in math, figures that are almost identical to 2023 after proficiency rates began steadily declining following the COVID-19 pandemic. An independent review of Delaware's education system is recommending the state invest anywhere from $600 million to $1 billion more in education and convert to a weighted funding formula based on student need, something Baltazar Lopez fully supports. Shoup says as of now, he's keeping his mind open.
I don't know what I don't know, so there could be a really great idea that I immediately might not think it may work, but after discussion and talking with people who have gone through that model, either in Delaware or other states, I may be very surprised of the success that they have had. So I'm definitely open. What I would like to see, and one thing that I know has to change, is we need to make sure that the majority of the money that's being funded and coming in through taxpayers is in the classroom themselves and reaching the teachers and the kids.
Affordable health care, particularly in Sussex County, has also been an at-large issue for the state. The General Assembly's biggest push this year to combat the issue was creating a hospital cost review board, a body in charge of making sure hospitals control their spending and adhere closely to healthcare cost spending benchmarks. Shoup voted against that bill, known as HB 350. Although the review board ultimately became law, ChristianaCare quickly filed a lawsuit against it, which is currently underway. Shoup cites the bill as yet another example of unnecessary governmental overreach and the stifling of healthy competition, while Baltazar Lopez believes it's the first step of many.
While House Bill 350 wasn't perfect, it is, I think, a step in the right direction. The overall issue here is that healthcare isn't healthcare if it's not affordable for people. So what do we do to help alleviate some of those costs, and how do we make sure that people can have access? One is to make sure that we're attracting and retaining professionals into the area, medical professionals. Making sure that we have, you know, some type of like tax credits for them or loan forgiveness programs for them to make sure that they come into Sussex County and stay here.
Shoup feels competition and pricing within health insurance, particularly within state employees' plans, is something that needs to be analyzed further.
One of the things that I really disagree with is how we handle our own operations with our health care for our state employees. We use a third party to look at the rates that people are paying and to say, yes, we're going to pay that, or no, we want to pay a lower fee. And it's my understanding that we don't often enough kind of disrupt that model.
When it comes to support for small businesses, Shoup wants to continue efforts to eliminate gross receipts tax and taxes on overtime pay, although he notes tax reform policies have not been very popular within the Democratic-controlled General Assembly.
Unfortunately, I haven't been too successful on tax policy, and I think the reason is most people in the legislature now believe that the more that the government taxes, the more money that they have, and the more programs will be able to give to residents of the state of Delaware. Unfortunately, they overlook that statistics show that the more money of their own that people have in their pocket, actually the more money they spend in the economy, and tax revenues go up as well.
Baltazar Lopez's focus is on enhancing Delaware's EDGE grant program, a competitive funding opportunity for small businesses to use on viability and sustainability.
I would definitely look into making sure that we're expanding those EDGE grant credits, because we've, in particular in the Hispanic community, there's even been organizations that are devoted just to help Hispanic small business owners, because we're just thriving and growing. In the US, for example, as a nation, there's a statistic that 1 in 4 new businesses are Latino-owned, and I think that can correlate really well into Delaware.
Milford is one of the fastest-growing cities in Delaware, with a population increase of almost 20% from 2020 to 2023. Both candidates agree boosting Milford's infrastructure and support services will be key in the coming years. But in addition to policy, Shoup is asking voters to consider why the makeup of the General Assembly is important in the years to come. Democrats hold a supermajority in the Senate and are just 2 seats away from holding the same in the House, with Democrats poised to flip Republican State Representative Mike Ramone's seat as he runs for governor. District 36 could be the deciding factor in Democrats gaining unyielding power in both chambers.
I think regardless of what party you are, if you're registered Republican, Democrat, or independent, you should take some time to think about that, because unchecked power on any level and in any party will lead to, in my opinion, more political ideology becoming law than what's good for residents.
But Baltasar Lopez argues he doesn't stand for a party or an ideology and instead stands for the district, and he believes he can deliver more for constituents.
I've gotten support from those who are from the far right to all those in the far left. People are more concerned about how we can improve real issues in our district, whether it's protecting our environment, making sure that we're holding developers accountable, making sure that we're expanding affordable access to healthcare, and making sure that we're making investments in education. They're not concerned about supermajorities or what that means.
While about 30% of registered voters in District 36 are either independents or non-affiliated, the remaining split between Republicans and Democrats is razor thin, with Republicans having only 154 more registered voters as of October 1st. Campaign donations have also become a point of contention. For the general election fundraising period as of October 7th, Shoup has raised just over $13,500, while Baltasar Lopez has accumulated $19,500. The Fannin family, a group of prominent Sussex County homebuilders, backed Patrick Smith in both recent GOP primary elections, but following his loss this year, they have now thrown their support behind Baltasar Lopez. Three members of the family maxed out the individual donor contribution of $600 each towards the Democratic candidate. But in a recent interview, Baltasar Lopez told Spotlight Delaware he made it very clear to the developers he cannot be bought. Shoup made comments worrying Baltasar Lopez doesn't realize this money has strings attached to it, which Baltasar Lopez denied. Shoup adds he understands why the Fannins don't back him. He has previously shown support for residents who have expressed concerns with the quality of the Fannins' work, which he believes has led to a personal vendetta against him. As of October 7th, Baltasar Lopez had roughly $2,700 more on hand to spend than Shoup leading up to the November 5th general election. Sarah Petrowich, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And again, a reminder, Delaware Public Media's election coverage is supported in part by a grant from Delaware Humanities, a state program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And stay with us, History Matters is next, with a closer look at the history of the supernatural in the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Native Americans and subsequent settlers were living on the land now known as Delaware long before it officially became a state in 1787. So the area's had a long time to stock up on stories of ghosts and hauntings between then and now. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Delaware native Josh Hitchens, author of Haunted History of Delaware and Eerie Delaware, for a deep dive into the first state's haunted history.
Speaking broadly here, what makes this state a prime place for the supernatural, ghost stories, haunted places? Can you give us a sense of Delaware's haunted history?
Sure thing. What a great question to begin with. I think Delaware has such a rich history and folklore from its very beginning, because there's stories, that have been handed down from the Lenni-Lenape people who, of course, lived here for many thousands of years before white settlers came to these shores. So there's that mine of folklore, but then, starting in the 1600s, when people from,
from, you know, the Dutch and the Swedes came and started settling the area, you know, brought their own stories and folklore. And everywhere, you know, in early American history, there were so much happened, so much incident, you know. And so that always leads to great stories, I think, you know, both documented in history and also folklore that has been passed down over time. It's important that these stories be passed down, you know, and read and retold, you know, because that way it preserves the culture, you know, of the past several hundred years in a way that could easily be lost. So even though Delaware is a small state, it has rich, rich stories in every corner of it. And every corner of it has some ghost stories as well.
And well, what are the qualifications in your mind in terms of what we define as haunted or what qualifies as one of these stories? Are there qualifications here? What about that?
Yeah, that's another great question. So for me as a writer, you know, because I grew up, you know, always interested in history and ghost stories and folklore since I was very, very young. And have obviously read many, many books on the subject before I started writing my own books. And for me, sort of my qualification for, you know, is this a story that I'm going to write a chapter about in a book or mention, is that I'm looking for stories where many different people have witnessed the same kind of paranormal phenomena or manifestation over time. You know, because there are some places in Delaware and everywhere where, you know, it's a place that's said to be haunted, but there's only really, oh, one person saw this one thing once and then not much since then. So like, there's not a lot to go on there. So the historian in me is really interested in like, have people seen this, you know, many, many times throughout history? And also, does the ghost story, does the legend allow an opportunity to talk about the broader history of a particular place? That's really what I'm looking for as a writer.
Right. So let's go through the list of creepy and haunted places in Delaware. Some of the major ones are the Old Christ Church, the Addisee Inn in Bethany. You said that the Rockwood Mansion in Wilmington is definitely the most haunted house in Delaware. So walk us through some of those major haunted spots and what makes them haunted.
Sure thing. Yeah. You know, those three places are very close to my heart. The Old Christ Church, which is in Sussex County, located near Laurel. My family grew up very near it. And Old Christ Church, I really think, and I've said before, that it is a criminally underrated historic site. It is a treasure of the First State. It is one of the most intact 18th century churches that exists on the East Coast. It is astonishingly well preserved. And the folks that run the Old Christ Church League, in Chief Stacy Northam Smith, was very kind in talking to me. Her and several other people have witnessed a woman in a black dress who has appeared occasionally when services are going on, like will stand, people notice her standing near the open door as if she's looking at, you know, the sermon or whatever. And then people turn and she's not there. They go outside and she's gone. People have also gotten what looks like apparitions and photographs there, including one that is in my book that, you know, it looks like a little girl wearing a bonnet, you know, from the olden days. The Rockwood Mansion that is in Wilmington is, again, like as you said, I think definitely the most haunted house in Delaware. Again, amazing, amazing historic site. You know, I talk about it in my book as sort of the Delaware version of Downton Abbey, you know, with terms of the luxury of the house and the grounds and, you know, the big personalities of the family members that lived and died there. But it has ghosts all over the place. I was recently there for a book event and the current director of Rockwood shared with me that their paranormal team recently said they believe they've identified 35 different entities throughout the house and the grounds. And I believe it. And they have extensive documentation of pretty much like every paranormal thing that has happened on the house and grounds since the 1970s when it started becoming open, you know, as a historic site. And they shared that wealth of information with me. I could write a whole book about Rockwood, the history of Rockwood itself someday. But it's a beautiful place, can also be very, very eerie, especially at night. If you go on one of their paranormal investigations, of which they have many, you're definitely going to experience something. I also, as you brought up, really love the Addisea Inn, which is in Bethany Beach. As an, you know, right, it's right on the ocean. Again, has, you know, it's a beautiful place, has really fascinating history. And various owner people who have run the inn over time have been very public with like the press and with visitors about unusual things that they've had happen there, you know, hauntings of different kinds, you know, seeing apparitions, hearing organ music playing in one of the rooms, you know, bathtubs that shake and things like that. So again, like, you have a pretty long history of documentation there. Yeah, so those are definitely three great spots.
What about the lesser known haunted hotspots then in Delaware, or just stories in general? What are those? What are we missing?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, which is one of the great things about Delaware. Story that I always really enjoy, again, hailing from my home turf of Sussex County. There's a lot of interesting folklore about witchcraft in that area, in the 18th and 19th centuries. Two notorious Sussex County witches were Dill Robinson and Molly Cahonk, both who were known in their communities to practice witchcraft, and people, you know, as many people have done throughout history, went to them for advice, for, you know, for healing, and also, you know, to put curses on people occasionally, which, you know, always has a price, you know. So there's fun stories about them. And there's also in the Great Cypress Swamp, which is, again, one of the amazing treasures that Delaware has, that place also has a history of being haunted. There was a fire there that many believe was caused by an exploding still back in the early 20th century. So it burnt a lot of it. So it's also known as the Burnt Swamp in some pieces throughout history. But people have encountered the ghost of a man there who is said to be the one who died in the still. But there's also the legend of our very own cryptid, who's known as the Selbyville Swamp Monster, that in particularly the 20th century, people would be going through the swamp or driving through, and they would see this, you know, inhuman creature, you know, think Delaware kind of version of Bigfoot in a way. And that really came to a head in the 1960s, or swarms of teenagers would go out to the swamp at night to try and see what they could find. And it wasn't until, I want to say, the early years of the 21st century, where a man named Fred Stevens came out saying that he had heard the legend of the swamp monster back in the 60s, and he actually started dressing up as the Selbyville Swamp Monster to scare people. But that, you know, it got a little too much room, because people started like bringing guns out into the swamp, trying to like be the one who could, you know, kill the swamp monster. So he stopped. But, you know, many years later came out saying that he had done that, and he had done it wearing his Aunt Dorothy's raccoon fur coat. And his Aunt Dorothy was a woman named Dorothy Williams Pepper, who wrote perhaps my favorite book about Delaware I've ever read. It's long out of print. Find a copy if you can. But it's called Folklore of Sussex County, Delaware. And in that book, she talks about the swamp monster legend. And I wonder if she ever knew that it was her own nephew that was doing it. So that's a fun one. You know, and even though that part of the swamp monster was faked in the 60s, there's stories, you know, that if you look online, of all, you know, all the way into the 21st century, people have been driving along Great Cypress Swamp and have seen, you know, what looks like a tall, you know, walking on two legs, very hairy, you know, kind of monster in the woods. So there might be something there.
So, as someone who's written extensively about all of this and gives paranormal tours, this is firmly your realm, Josh. I feel like I've heard a lot about, as far as these spirits go, or ghosts and whatnot, I feel like I've heard a lot about, you know, their lovers scorned or their ghosts seeking retribution of some kind. What keeps these spirits around in your mind?
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, and I think that's something that is very interesting that, you know, it hasn't been explained by science yet. But, you know, what always gets me and how I counter that is like, you know, there are stories of people experiencing ghosts all the way back, like into recorded history. There's ghost stories in the Bible. People over the course of our human existence have been experiencing something. There's something that is happening there. You know, what it is scientifically, who knows? I've always kind of thought, you know, of course there's an unfinished business, or like it could potentially tie a spirit to a place or major event that happened that had a lot of emotional energy expended. And so that event is sort of replayed on a loop over time. So I think for me, there's kind of different categories. There's like, there are ghosts that it is just sort of, you're seeing a thing on a loop as if you're watching it on a screen today, you know, that doesn't really interact with people. It's just sort of this thing going on and on that, you know, people happen to catch glimpses of if they're there at the right moment. And then there are ghosts that are more like what some in like the paranormal community call like intelligent hauntings, where like it is a spirit that is aware of its time and place and interacts with people who are there in the here and now, you know, like such as like making things move or fall or, you know, touching people, things like that. So I think those are the two main categories, you know. And again, like, have science explained it? No, but like, we've been experiencing something over the course of our human history. So like that you can't really deny.
Thanks to author Josh Hitchens and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn more about a mentorship program that helps support those who've been diagnosed with breast cancer. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime. And although fewer than 1% of men are diagnosed with the disease, their odds of survival are worse. To help with the stressors, anxieties, and uncertainty that come with having breast cancer, the Delaware Breast Cancer Coalition offers a peer mentorship program with free one-on-one support to those who've been diagnosed. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sat down with Connie Holdridge, Survivorship Director at the Delaware Breast Cancer Coalition, to learn more about this mentorship program here in Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what role this peer mentor support program plays in Delaware and why you think it's a necessary part.
I think it's a very necessary part of anybody's journey, is to have somebody that they can bounce ideas off of. Somebody that can say, yes, I went through radiation and I'm okay. Or yes, I did chemo and my hair did grow back. You don't know what you don't know, and that's hard. Most people that I run into, and I'm one of those people, don't ask questions of their doctors. They take what the doctor says and they do it. If the doctor says, take 2 steps to the left, you do, or I did. But people will say to me, why am I supposed to take 2 steps to the left? Which they should have asked the doctor in the first place. But a lot of people don't ask their doctors these questions. They'll ask a nurse before they'll ask a doctor. And they'll ask me before they ask a nurse, because I'm not a medical person and I have nothing to gain or lose. I'm just trying to give them a personal someone to talk to that can help. So we have support groups and we have activities and we have ways to calm yourself and ways to relieve anxiety. The biggest part of having a peer mentor is having someone that says, I'm still here. I survived this. So that by itself says, oh my gosh, this is great. Somebody did survive this. So I'm not necessarily going to die. And then we need to get them calm enough to hear what the doctors are saying. You know, the doctor starts with big words or words that you're not familiar with. And instead of asking what it is, what it means, you feel like, oh, I probably should know that. So I'll just pretend I know that. And then they come to me and they say, well, I don't understand what this means. And I can explain it to them and say, it's okay. You shouldn't understand it because you haven't been here before. You know, you're learning a new language. Sometimes people need the support. I have taken people to their doctor's appointments and sat with them, and they feel more comfortable because they're by themselves. And you should never go to a doctor's appointment by yourself if you're in cancer treatments. You should go with somebody else because you're going to hear only part of what's being said because you're overwhelmed. And if you have a person with you, that person can hear all of it. And then you all can discuss, did he really say that I should have this kind of surgery or that kind of surgery? And we can talk about it. Like I said, we have support groups. Okay. We have support groups, one in each county, and they are in person and on Zoom. So you can join any of the support groups that you want. We have a support group in Spanish. We have a support group for women of color. And we have a whole group just for young women. We take and train people that have finished their journey, that are ready to give back, which is what I did in 2006. And we train them to be a certified peer mentor.
I am curious as to if you could talk a little bit more about what these trainings look like for the people who are ready to give back.
Okay, so the requirement is that they be a survivor of breast cancer. And let's clarify that. Survivor of breast cancer means that from the day you are diagnosed, you are a survivor. As long as you're still alive, you are a survivor. So we have metastatic women and men who will be on medication for the rest of their lives. But that doesn't mean that their lives are over. Some of them will say, well, I'm not a survivor because I'm not cancer free. No, you're not cancer free, but you're surviving. And so we do have metastatic mentors as well, because that's another whole situation to deal with. We have a PowerPoint presentation that goes through what it is to be a mentor. And the most important part being listening and not talking. So I am listening to what you're saying and trying to help you articulate what you're saying and understand what you're saying, as opposed to spending the entire conversation telling you about my treatments. We're talking about what you have to do, how you can, my husband doesn't like me anymore. Well, that is probably not the case, but that's what you're feeling. So let's delve into that. People at work don't understand. That's probably not the case either. But again, why do you feel that way? People are getting tired of hearing me. Well, okay, that's why you talk to me, because I'm not going to get tired of hearing you. There's a lot of emotional questions there. And so we can connect you with as many different people as you want to talk, just to ask that question. And that gives that patient a little more control. Because one thing we don't have is control. You know, I can't control what's going on with my body right now. I got cancer. I can't control it. But if you can find different people and different opinions and hear different stories, then you're in more control. And the more information you have, the better off you are. Again, it all comes down to your decision and your choice, but make an informed decision.
I think it's really interesting to sort of turn this conversation to agency for people who are, you know, have just received a diagnosis or who are, you know, currently battling cancer. So I was interested to ask you about the significance of having a mentor, of having someone who has that shared experience, but also the sort of agency that they're given in being allowed to say, you know, what kind of mentor they're looking for, age group or race or gender. Can you talk a little bit about that and the significance of it?
Most people are more comfortable with people that are like them. Okay. Doesn't matter what your race is, what your ethnicity is, what your sexual preference is. Most people are more comfortable with people that are of like mind. And if we're getting into some serious soul searching, when you're talking with your mentor, you want somebody that you feel is on the same wave that you are, on the same line. Sometimes it doesn't matter at all, but sometimes I will get that question because, say, someone who is African-American, They'll say, my doctor's not listening to me. Maybe they're right. I don't know, because I don't know their doctor. But they will ask to be set up with someone who is also African-American and see if they have a shared experience. Is it me or is it the doctor? And to that question, I always say, if you don't think that doctor's listening to you, find another doctor. Because that's the primary thing you need is somebody that's willing to listen to your concerns, your thoughts. So if we can get somebody that is like-minded, that shares same kinds of principles, same kinds of spiritual feelings. I've had people that say, I only want to talk to somebody who's Catholic, okay? Or somebody that's Jewish, because of whatever is in their background that says, this is something that's different for me. Personally, I think that having breast cancer is sufficient for somebody to help me because they understand where I'm coming from. Our whole purpose is to try to calm someone down. You heal better if you are not stressed. If you're stressed, you're going to make it worse. If you've got the flu and you are stressed out because you can't do something, you know, other things, it's going to take you longer to get over the flu than if you are listening and following directions and taking whatever medicine they've given you and laying down and resting. So these kinds of things are really important to help people de-stress. So one of the ways we de-stress is talking, obviously. But we have a whole program called Nurture with Nature. And just stepping outside and taking a breath of fresh air and walking through a path or looking at flowers or looking at the sky or kayaking. We've done all these things in Nurture with Nature. It does relieve the stress. You are now enjoying nature. You're healing better. And when you're healing better, you're feeling better. We also encourage writing or journaling or reading. So if you're a knitter, knit, you know, because you've got to focus on what you're doing. And that's going to keep your mind from going all over the place. It's like meditating. We want you to calm down. We also have survivor socials. Now, a survivor social is a fun activity, like make it a Christmas wreath or a Thanksgiving wreath. And that is not about breast cancer, but it's only open to breast cancer survivors of any age. So when you're there and you have a commonality of all the people that are there, and you don't have to explain yourself. Everybody is on the same, has been there, is on the same wavelength. And eventually it does turn to conversations about breast cancer, but you know, we're there for fun, just something that is relaxing. And it's easy to say, relax and don't do that. And don't worry. That's not a good thing. In fact, we have a whole list of things not to say, like it's going to be okay. Don't say that. That diminishes how I feel about what's going on right now. Okay. Don't say, don't worry about it. Well, of course you're going to worry about it. You know, these are things that you are platitudes that don't do anything but make the person you're talking to feel either less heard or angry.
Thanks to Connie Holdridge, the Delaware Breast Cancer Coalition's Sussex County Program Director, and our Abigail Lee for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee and Sarah Petrowich, along with our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.